to Think Digital, Act Human, a podcast where we tell the everyday stories of digital specialists working on extraordinary projects. I'm Adobia Thatcher, a product manager here at the Department for Education. Okay, so today is a particularly special episode because we have not one, not two, but three digital and tech experts from DfE. So in a second, I'm going to introduce you to them. But for now, just grab yourself a cup of coffee. We'll wait for you. We're excited, but we will wait. And now I'm going to introduce you. So we've got Keisha Herbert, a senior user researcher from Teacher Services, Courtney Allen, an associate product manager from Get Help Buying for Schools, and Virginia Brown, a content design lead from the Apprenticeship Service. Welcome, everybody.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
So this is a special episode for another reason. If you're someone just listening to our dulcet tones, you probably wouldn't have noticed anything, but I'm going to tell you, we're all Black digital and tech specialists. I wanted to put something positive out into the universe, I guess. I think this is really to all my guests as well. Like the last 18 months, say, has been pretty kind of miserable for everybody on the planet. We've had a pandemic, we've had lockdowns, we've had missed occasions with family and friends and things like that. But recently, if you are a member of the Black diaspora, we've had some extra things happening as well. So everybody knows about George Floyd's murder. And recently with the Euros, we've had abuse happening towards players who really did nothing wrong at all, except play whilst Black, I guess. So I just thought, you know what? We've had all that kind of negativity. Let's have a space where it's just positivity. We're hearing about the great things that Black people are doing in their careers, how they moved into this world of digital and tech. I want to know your stories. I'm going to kind of come to you one by one and just find out a little bit about what you actually do. So like, if I come to you, Keisha, first, so senior user researcher, Teacher Services, there are people who will be listening who have no idea what a senior user researcher is. When your mum asks you, what do you say?
She does still ask me quite a lot, so I still have to keep telling her what I do. Senior user researcher is basically understanding the user needs. So if you're designing a service, developing a service, you have to understand what the user needs to ensure that that service is built for them and built to really meet those needs. So that's what I do. I go out and speak to people. So within Teacher Services, I'm speaking to potential teachers because I work on the Get Into Teaching website. So that's all about inspiring, informing and reassuring people that want to get into teaching. So I go out and speak to them and understand what can we do better? How can we improve the website to ensure that they have all the information they need and they understand what to expect when they're going along their journey to becoming a teacher? That's ultimately what I do.
Awesome. Thanks, Keisha. So let's come to you next, Courtney. And this is a bit awkward. Like when I was first looking for who I might invite to be on this panel of guests, I was like, Courtney Allen, that name seems so familiar. And then, of course, I remembered I was one of the people who interviewed you for your job.
Yes.
Don't feel like you have to be super polite to me. It's fine. Say whatever you want to say. Courtney, what does an associate product manager do?
Associate product manager is a trainee role. So product management is kind of sitting at the heart between user experience, tech, and the business team to kind of systematically figure out what is the best thing to build next and why. And so you'd work regularly with your user researchers and your content designers to work through what they've discovered and decide what's the best thing to build next and the most important thing for both the business and the user.
So Virginia, Courtney just said that he works closely with people like you as content designers. Is that true? Do you work closely with product managers? And if so, what are you doing?
Yes, we do. Content design is, I would also say, at the heart of things. We are problem solvers, and without content, you don't have a product. There's nothing there. It doesn't exist. It's empty space. So you kind of need content designers to help you solve that problem or solve the ask, as I like to think, and it's not all just about writing the words. It's about creating the right content at the right time in the right space as well. And when you serve up to people or our users, like, what is that content and what is the expectation? Like, what are they supposed to do with that information? Because everything we do, especially within government, must have a purpose. There must be an ask to it. Nobody comes to us to browse as much as people like to think. They come to complete a task. So by creating this content, like, what do they need to do next? What is the next call to action? And working with our product owners and product managers, it's really important to understand, have we done that? Have we solved the ask? And is it what everyone expects? Like, we don't want to all be in one meeting and come out with several different ideas and the results really different to what you expect. So it's having those open conversations and really getting to the detail of always asking those questions. Have we actually solved what we intended to at the beginning of a project?
So before I worked for the civil service, I actually worked over at the BBC, and I thought I knew what Agile was. I knew like the different roles that would be like on a digital delivery team, for example. But we had UX designers, and that was kind of like the only designers that I knew really existed. And then I came to DfV, and all of a sudden I've got content designers, I've got interaction designers, I've got service designers. So are you able to say, Virginia, like, how are you different from those other types of designers, and how do you kind of work with them?
Yeah, so content design, it's a fairly, in the grand scheme of things, it's a fairly new profession. Like, it's, I think, 10 years old, perhaps. Don't quote me on that. But the work of a content designer is more than just writing the words or filling in the boxes. We work really closely in what I call the UCD triangle. So that's user centered design with our user researcher or interaction designer or UX designer. It depends where you are. Because before I came to DfE, I'd never heard of interaction designer. I'd always worked with UX designers, user experience designers. But those three, we work in tandem. So with the user researchers, they speak to the people who are using our services. And we can't create content out of thin air. Well, if we do, but it will fail. So we work really closely with our user researchers. So what are they saying? What do they need? What are their actual needs rather than their wants or the business wants? It's a balancing act. I'm sure Keisha can attest to that. And also with our interaction designer, we don't just fill in boxes. So we don't wait for them to create something and then we kind of fill in the content boxes. Content designers look at the whole package from end to end. So bringing in the user research, like, what have they actually said? Leaning on our interaction design colleagues, what can we design to make that work? How does it work? Because often words won't help. It's very easy, I think, to create a glorious long document that's 60 pages long because it's really tangible and you can show someone what you've done. But if your users are time poor or they don't have the reading ability or they don't frankly want to read a 60-page document, then you're going to fail at the very beginning. So as a content designer, we look at, what do our users want? What are they actually trying to do or complete? And what's the best way to serve that? You know, it could be these people might prefer video. That works better for them because content isn't just words. It's not just the written word. It's video. It's a podcast that we're on today. It could be a webinar. It could be a series of blogs, all manner of things. And as content designers, we have to think in that way. And we bring along our other colleagues who are not in the content space. So when we're working with policy, we're trying to find out, what's your policy intent and how do you know it's been successful? Always thinking about the KPIs because it has to be measurable. Like, I can't tell you if something's worked if we don't set the key performance indicators at the beginning and say that this will be a success when someone does X. That's really important. So as content designers, that's what we're thinking of. So then we can go to our product managers and say, hey, got a great idea. We're going to do a webinar instead because actually our users are not going to sit and read this document. They're going to listen to it or they're going to learn. They want to learn something. They want something tangible. And that's what content design is. And that's what it's working with our two other professions. And it's really important that we work closely together because if we have our user researcher go out and do this lovely research, they speak to like 20 people and they come back with some really key and important information to say, actually, the assumptions we made at the start are completely wrong and we need to go in a different direction. If a content person doesn't know that, they'll keep going with the assumptions they had at the beginning of a project and it will still fail. So it's really important we have those user research conversations and work closely together. So the content we're creating aligns with the user needs that have been found that they've done in the beginning. And then we bring in the interaction designer who can help us design. And this is when you think of designer, you know, what the person's going to see, what they're going to look at on the screen and how it will work. And then we can work together to ensure it's accessible for our users. Is it something they're actually going to do? For example, is it the form they're going to fill out? How many pages do we need to go through? It's things like that. It's hand in hand. You can't have one without the other, in my opinion. So when there's a project that's whipped up, a delivery team, when one of the triangles missing, so there's no content designer, there's no user researcher, I get very nervous because like, who's doing what in this profession? You know, because as much as I love user research, because I'm quite a nosy person, I can't go out and start doing research with people. It's not my profession. I need those expertise within my team.
So you're hearing that, Keisha. Virginia needs your expertise within that team.
I like to hear it.
So, yeah, you know what, Keisha, let's stick with you for a second. Can you give me like an example of like something you're working on at the moment? How did it start and how do you start breaking the problem down to know what to do with it?
Yeah, I can give you an example. So at the moment, I'm actually working with different people in my team. So the interaction designer, content designer. And they've come to us, the researchers in the team, and they've said, okay, we want to develop this page, which is a page around events. They want to develop that. They've got their assumptions, but they want to make sure that when they actually change that design is based on the user's perspective. So everything that they change is user-centered. So they want us to go out and speak to users to understand what they think of the current page so that they can then go off and then develop new designs based off the back of that research. So that's how it tends to work within the team. And it's really nice because there's value seen in understanding user needs, but also the research that we do. So it tends to be that other people in the team come to us, ask us whether we've got an understanding from previous research or actually that we need to go out and speak to our users. And then they bake that into their, I guess, designs and developing the service. So, yeah, I think being user-centered is key and just making sure that the users are at the heart of everything that is created within the service.
I know what I do as a product manager. If I'm asked to kind of look at a problem and see if it really is a problem, like, you know, how to lead a discovery, move something that's worth looking at into alpha or beta or whatever. Courtney, how is this for you as an associate? I have to say, like, I haven't really thought about that very much because what I've noticed so far is that there tends to be a product manager and an associate product manager on a lot of DFE digital delivery teams. So I've always kind of seen my role as trying to mentor my associate product manager and make sure that if they go for like the next step up, they're ready to go. Or if there's like a project that suddenly comes up, that they feel confident leading that project. For you, like, do you kind of like hope that you'll be given a meaty piece of something to own? Or do you have to kind of like fight for it? Let people know that, yeah, I can do this, or like, here's my idea. Like, what's your approach as someone coming in as an associate product manager?
It's a bit of both, if I'm honest. I think, the good thing about being here is you're working with people that want to see you succeed. So they're going to give you opportunities. The product manager that I work with gives me, you know, some meaty pieces of work, but there are also opportunities to help out the team with other areas. Let's say we don't have enough user research resource, you can jump on and fill in and do some diary studies, or you can jump in and help out with synthesizing some user research that's already been done. So it's both. You have opportunities are given to you, and there's kind of a plan for helping you to succeed and progress. So kind of it's looking at your capabilities and where your strengths and helping you build on your strengths, as well as kind of ironing out some of your weaknesses.
Yeah, I've always thought of being a product manager as you've got the traditional sort of strategic long-term view of a product as a product manager. Then you've got like this sort of daily tactical, I'm working with the engineers and the BAs sort of product owner space. And on top of that, there's this kind of, if it's no one's role, you can't let that fall because it's not officially in your job title. Like, if it's not officially in anyone's job title, I always see it as it like being in my job title to either do it or delegate it. It's when people say servant leader, I never really used to get that, but I guess you are doing things for the team to make sure the team is as healthy as it can be. But anyway, listen, we've talked about your jobs today, and that has been very interesting. But I want to know, how did you all get into your roles, and particularly how did you get into sort of digital tech roles in the civil service? I'm fascinated by this because I just don't think it's the first thing you think of when you're starting to think about a job in digital tech. Civil service might not come to everyone's mind straight away. So how did you get here?
Yeah, I can talk about my trajectory and just how I got into the civil service. I guess my route might be quite different to other people's. So I worked in boutique qualitative research agencies for the past 10 years. So I've done a lot of traditional market research, so quite different to what I'm doing right now. And I worked across lots of different sectors from energy, charity, cookie brands, like very, very varied. And also lots of different projects from advertising to sort of international. And I think what made me take the plunge into civil service and DfE, which was only a few months ago and very new to the civil service, was that I've always found UX and digital just very fast-paced and exciting. But I've also really enjoyed to see the focus on accessibility and diversity inclusion. You don't see that sort of emphasis when you're working in more traditional market research. And then in terms of being in civil service and DfE, I think I really wanted to work on more meaningful projects. So working on services across education was just very motivating for me, but also to be involved in those end-to-end projects rather than just going off, doing a bit of research, delivering it to your client and then not hearing about it again. I'm now involved in the full life cycle of that project, but also in the strategy as well. So that's how I got into it. And so far, really enjoying being in that digital space within teacher services.
And what about you, Virginia? Any advice for people who have heard you talk about content design and are fired up and they want to know more about it? Like, how do you even walk towards that journey?
Yeah, I'd say, so I got into it in my last role. I was a web editor, and it was purely, I focused on web copy and copywriting. And then my head of department at the time was like, we do more than that. She'd heard of content design, and we went on this content design training course, learned more about what that was and what it encompassed, and realized actually, yeah, we do more than just edit. We are having those conversations with our colleagues about like what content they want, the types of content they do, what, you know, what's the ask. And so content design is, I think of it as like solving a puzzle. You're trying to solve a problem with either, you know, with research to hand, which is quite nice, or often you don't, and you're kind of having to make your best guess, and you're having to balance the needs of a business with the needs of your user. And so as a content designer, anybody wanting to get into it, I like it. It's really exciting because I think you see that end-to-end journey. You can see if what you've produced actually helps people. Does it solve their problem? Or do you need to do a little bit more work because people have to use your content? And it's not all, you know, guns and glory. You know you've done well when people don't realize they've been pushed along a journey, essentially. It kind of happens in the background. It's very subtle. And you know you've done well when people just complete things. And they're like, oh, that was really easy. And that's just music to my ears when people say that. That was really easy because I know I've done my job. But the role of a content designer is to make complex things very simple to the user. Like, because something is complex within your department or within your company, your user doesn't need to know that. That's not their business. They just need to complete the thing they've come to complete. They don't need all the stress and hassle that you've gone through. You need to shield them from that and to show them it's actually very simple. You take them along a journey and they can complete the thing quite easily. And people want to get into content design. It's, you know, if you're curious, like to solve problems and can work really well with different people, that's kind of what you need, I think, because often writing is like the last thing you do. That might, you know, shock some people, but it really is the last thing you'll do. Often you're bringing people along the journey with you. You're explaining things. You're trying to really get to the problem, because often the problem you're presented with initially isn't the problem. It's easy, I think, sometimes to jump to solution. And it's actually, well, what we're trying to fix, like, what is the issue? That they're not filling in the form, or they're filling it in incorrectly. And what is incorrect about it? Like, what do you need them to do? And often when you ask people what they need to do, they tell you very succinctly. But then what they produce is all of their internal struggle to then serve up to users. It's like, we cut that out and make it very, very simple for them.
Courtney, you have like the perfect job for someone who is like aspiring to be a product manager. How did you get into that? How did that happen?
Yeah, so my recent experiences as a digital officer, and that's kind of a jack of all trades digital role. So I did a bit of web management, a bit of social media, a bit of content design, and a bit of project management. And I was kind of never getting very deep into either of those disciplines, and kind of looking to get deep into one. So for context, my previous role was in local government. So I worked at an organization called London Councils. And we'd recently signed a local government digital declaration, which kind of meant that we needed to start designing services that best meant the needs of citizens. And this kind of led me down a rabbit path into doing less project management and more product management, working more agile ways and building prototypes and testing it with users. And then, you know, finding out how to improve things and then building again, and kind of got to the end of that process and thought, I think product management is something I wanted to do. I explored a course in it, and then I started seeing, you know, associate product manager roles and programs start popping up all over the place. And I wanted to stay within like government area, kind of wanting to do work that had an impact on people's lives.
Yeah, I think it's the money is pretty good for the market, but let's face it, those people who come into the civil service are here because we want something that's very meaningful. We want to help other people. So yeah, I've kind of heard that. I've heard all of you say something like that that really resonates with me too. I think in the spirit of adding something positive into the conversation about Black professionals, Black working professionals, I wanted to kind of do, it's a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek exercise actually, because I asked my white colleagues if there were any questions that they have always wanted to ask a Black person, but felt a little bit too shy to ask. And so I've got a list of things here, and we'll see what we can do for time. But one of them, and the reason why this idea came to mind is because I started off by talking about George Floyd. And I remember I was actually at the BBC at the time, and a friend of mine there phoned me up the day after and just was like, hey, are you okay? I just, you know, saw this news, just wanted to see if you're okay. And I was like super surprised by that. I was not expecting that. But I was also incredibly touched that he had thought to do that. And then at the same time, there were people who I thought I was quite close to as work colleagues who didn't say anything, because I think they were like, it's kind of like when someone dies, right? You're like, do I mention this, or do would they prefer that I don't speak about this at all? So I kind of wanted to say, like, if you have any questions, this is a time to ask, because we're a friendly bunch and we'll see what we can do. So here are some of the questions that came through. Some are a bit funnier than others. So let's see. One of them has said, how do you feel when asked about your ethnic background? I'm often asked where I'm from because of my accent, and I'm always happy to say Romania, but I wonder how Black colleagues feel when asked something similar.
I would say to that, accept the first answer they give you. There's nothing worse than if you say, oh, I'm from, for example, London. And like, oh, but where are you really from? That, don't say that. That's rude.
Yes.
I couldn't have put it any better.
Just accept the first answer.
Yeah.
And I think, like, picking up off the back of that, I think the reason why people ask you where you're from is because they can kind of hear something that lets them know, like, oh, that doesn't sound like anywhere in the UK. They must not be from here. If you're kind of saying, but where are you really from to a Black person, that says, well, this Black person couldn't possibly be from here. And the only reason why is because they're Black, right? So that's kind of like the step that so many people make without meaning to be rude. And I totally get that, because I grew up in Devon. So I literally was the Black population for a significant part of the 90s. So yeah, totally get it. As Virginia says, accept the first answer that people give you gracefully and we'll all be happy. That's pretty cool. Okay, so someone said, how does it make you feel when white people get it wrong? Is there anything that would help you in that situation? Could acknowledgement that they've got it wrong be useful? Well, firstly, I'm going to say to that question, thank you for making yourself vulnerable and sending in a question. We really appreciate it. I'd say that it's 2021 at the time that we're recording this, and I imagine for like people of a certain generation, it's a very awkward time, because there are men and women and people who are non-binary, and there are Black people and then mixed race people. And how do you refer to people? And I feel like for some people, it can be a bit kind of like daunting, like hoping that you don't offend people. And I will tell you right now, at some point, you're going to get it wrong. And that's okay. If you accidentally refer to someone as a man and they correct you and say, well, actually, I prefer you said they or them, just, it's kind of similar to the thing that Virginia said. However someone self-identifies, that's what you go with. If you get it wrong that first time and they correct you, then just go with the correction that they've given you. If you get it wrong and they're immediately super angry with you and there's no conversation, it's just kind of anger that's coming at you, in a way, I would say that's almost not your fault. Like, just don't try not to take it personally. Like, all you can do is, when people correct you, just try to do better next time? Just try to kind of like live and learn. Is there anything I'm missing from that answer, guys?
Yeah, I think it's just important to be open to learning. I think that's the main thing. So if you've got it wrong, rather than being precious about getting it wrong, that you're open to building your understanding. So then the next time when that situation arises, you don't get it wrong again and another person isn't affected. So I think it's just openness, and that's in all areas of life. But I think in those situations, just put your hands up, say, okay, I'm sorry, that was wrong. And now I know what to do next.
So another person has asked, have you felt uplifted by any of the actions people have taken in response to incidents of racism?
Yeah, I'd say definitely after the Euros, when like in the immediate aftermath, there was a lot of hatred for Jadon Sancho, Marcus Rashford and Bukayo Saka. Yeah, it was very hard to watch. But I was uplifted by seeing, you know, the outpouring of love that lots of fans gave to Bukayo Saka. He missed the last penalty, but he was like, you know, the 19-year-old that, you know, was given all the pressure in the world. The mural that went up north for Marcus Rashford as well. Like, I think there was definitely lots of hate at the time, like in the immediate aftermath, but then a huge outpouring of love that came after that.
That's a great answer. I'd say for myself, I'm someone who lives in the north of the country, and I was on a tram a couple of years ago, and it was quite a busy tram, and this white man who identified himself at the time as a police officer told me to get off the tram, and I didn't really know. I mean, I didn't know if he was a police officer or not, and secondly, I didn't really know what my rights were in that situation. Do I have to immediately do what someone says if they say they're a police officer? So I just kind of stood there. But I also was like, I really need to be on this tram because I'm actually kind of late getting somewhere. So this is the last chance for me to get there on time. And as I was thinking that, there were other people getting on the tram who were white, and he didn't say anything to them. And I realized, oh, that's what this is. And he started getting louder and more kind of obnoxious, shouting at me to get off. And this voice in the crowd, like somewhere buried deep in the crowd, this one woman said, just leave her alone. And it was like it broke the spell for him. And he immediately backed down, just kind of grumbled to himself a bit. But then the tram moved off. And when he eventually got off the tram, like all these people kind of came up to me afterwards and they were like, oh my gosh, that was such blatant racism. It was so disgusting the way he was talking to you. And I was kind of like, where were you 5 minutes ago when I felt extremely alone? But I will always remember that one woman, I didn't even see her face, just saying something. And I think it can feel intimidating if you're like a bystander, but just that one thing you can do, it can really uplift people. It can really give them the strength that they need in that moment to kind of carry on with something that is humiliating or, you know, kind of upsetting. So please, I would say, like, be that voice, be that bodiless voice, and not necessarily the people after the fact, you know? But that was something that was extremely uplifting for me. Okay, so we're coming to kind of like the end of this. And I will say, as positive as I want to be in this whole case, my digital experts, like, there's going to be something else. We know that's just kind of a fact of being a black person in Britain, right? There's going to be something else that happens. And in that case, like, how would you like your kind of colleagues to approach you or not approach you? Like, what would be cool behavior for you?
Well, a really great example for me was after the Euros 2020 and after what Courtney mentioned happened to the three footballers. And I felt that the response from teacher services was great and not something I've experienced before in the workplace. So they put up a statement on Slack and they were just acknowledging that it had happened, because sometimes I find that these things happen, they go viral, and they're quite difficult situations for us to be in at the time. But then you get to work the next day and it's not mentioned at all. And everyone talks about everything that happened around the awful situation. So I think actually having your team, your colleagues actually acknowledge what happened is really important to let you know that they understand and they appreciate that actually it might be a difficult thing that you went through the night before. And so that's what happened on Slack. But in addition to that, and following what you were saying, Adobe, about action, they also put in place a safe space. So there was actually a space for people of colour to go if they wanted to talk about this issue in more depth. So there's an understanding that maybe people don't want to talk about it with white colleagues, but they might appreciate talking about with people who can empathise or have experienced a similar thing. So for me, I think that's a really good way of A, acknowledging, and B, sort of putting in some action. So I think that's a really good starting point.
And a really good positive note to end on as well. Thank you so, so, so much to my guests, Keisha Herbert, Courtney Allen, and Virginia Brown. I really enjoyed this discussion today, and I hope that it has done for you, listener, what I hoped it would do, which is to put some positivity out into the universe. I want to say thank you to the show producers as well, Rosie Ruff, Lou Mullen, and Natty Williams. So that's it. Thank you very much for joining us. In the meantime, if you want to hear anything more from us specifically, why not tell us? You can always get in touch with us on our Twitter, which is @DFE_digitaltech. And if you're not really on Twitter, you can always leave a comment on our blog post, which is dfedigital.blog.gov.uk. Thank you so much for joining us for this cup of tea. Speak to you next time. Bye. So if you want to hear us talk about something specifically in the future, why not tell us? You can get in touch with us on Twitter. And I actually don't know what our Twitter address is, so I can't give a shout out to that. But I'm sure you can find DFE Twitter on there somewhere with a bit of a Google. And leave us a comment or come to the DFE blog post and post there underneath one of our pod episodes. So that's it. Thank you for joining us for a cup of tea. Speak to you next time. Bye.